The Guardian.
And we are delighted to be able to report to you today that we have seen what we thought was unseeable. We have seen and taken a picture of a black hole. Here it is.
Black holes have long featured in science fiction movies as dark, swirling objects that swallow anything that crosses their threshold. So it's easy to forget that we've never actually seen one before. That was until earlier this month, when the Event Horizon Telescope announced that it had produced an image of a black hole called M87.
What you're seeing here is the last photon orbit. What you are seeing is evidence of an event horizon. By laying a ruler across this black hole, we now have visual evidence for a black hole. We now
know that. But more than that, it is a test of Einstein's ideas about the nature of space and time. And so this week, we'll delve into the decades of research that led to the achievement.
I guess that black holes, as we refer to them, really received prominence around the early 1900s.
And we speak to one of the scientists involved in producing the image and find out why it's more than just a pretty picture.
It's just remarkable, incredible, really, that we're able to have an image of what is, in effect, the edge of our universe.
I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.
Hi, my name's Dr. Matthew Middleton. I'm a lecturer and Ernest Rutherford Fellow at the University of Southampton.
So this is maybe not the most straightforward question, but what are black holes?
You're right, that's not the most straightforward of questions, but let me see if I can answer it. To answer that question, we have to understand what is meant by something called an event horizon. And to understand that, we have to really use metaphors. So if we stand on the Earth and throw something up in the air, say an apple or your smartphone or whatever you have to hand, a friend, I don't know, typically it's going to fall back to Earth. So it turns out that to make it escape Earth's gravity, you need to throw it at about 11 kilometers per second, which is unbelievably fast. We call this the escape speed, and that relates to the mass and the size of the object on which we're standing, in this case, the Earth. Mm-hmm. Now, imagine that we're shining a torch upwards. Now, in principle, there's a mass and radius of that object for which the escape speed is the speed of light, or faster. And the first person to come up with that idea was a chap called John Mitchell in 1783, would you believe? And he named that object a dark star. All right, so we're getting to the point eventually, I promise. You can recast that idea by saying that an object is dark when it lies within its event horizon. And the event horizon is the point from within which not even light can escape. So it's that point where the escape speed is the speed of light.
So just to make sure I'm following you. So on Earth, if you wanted to escape the pull of Earth's gravity, you'd have to go at 11 kilometers per second. So like what we require a rocket to do to get out away from the Earth. And if we had an even more massive object, that escape speed would be bigger.
Absolutely.
As you get bigger and bigger and bigger, you eventually reach a point where to escape from the object, you'd have to be going at the speed of light.
Precisely. And that point, that boundary, is called the event horizon. So that's like where the point where the escape speed is the speed of light.
Remember that the bigger the mass of an object, the more powerful its gravitational pull. And so if you have enough mass concentrated in one place, you can get a situation where the gravity is so extreme that not even light can escape. It was the pastor, John Michel, who was the first person to theorise that such objects might exist in 1783. Except he called them dark stars rather than black holes.
Telescope, so successful.
And when this guy came up with the dark star idea, did people think that these things really existed, or was it more of a theoretical idea? Like if you ever had something that big or that massive, you know, in theory nothing would be able to escape from it. But did people think they were really out there, these dark stars?
That's a phenomenal question, and I don't really know the answer, because this guy who was, I think he was a pastor and a geologist and this sort of, you know, wonderful guy who did all these things, a lot of his work had been lost until, you know, fairly recently. And 1783, I mean, goodness only knows what people were talking about back then, but I suspect it was more of a theoretical exercise rather than, you know, let's go look with our, you know, essentially fairly simple telescopes back then and see if we can find anything that matches.
So when did people actually shift from, you know, this was a kind of theoretical idea, but at that point they had no way of going out and checking whether these things were really out there. When did this start being accepted as something that really existed in the universe?
I guess that black holes, as we refer to them, really received prominence around the early 1900s. So Albert Einstein, who we all know was this sort of amazing sort of wizard of physics, formulated equations of general relativity. And just to take a second, general relativity is this amazing idea and picture of the universe where gravity is a result of the curvature of space and time as a consequence of mass or energy. And this chap called Karl Schwarzschild and his collaborators solved Einstein's equations under one specific condition, and that's we have a symmetric non-rotating mass. And the solution to that produced what was called a coordinate singularity, which is the event horizon, and that's where black holes really started to take shape. Einstein didn't believe that result for various different reasons, but from then on we entered what's called the golden age of astronomy, really. And a lot of enormous theoretical work was done. And then eventually our ability to observe the universe caught up. And that's when we started making these phenomenal discoveries.
When did we get the first evidence? So, you know, obviously it's only recently that we've been able to observe black holes more directly. But when did we get the first evidence that there were these dark objects out there that we couldn't see, but we could kind of detect their presence?
So black holes are, as you say, dark, unless they're eating a lot of material in a process we call accretion. And accretion normally takes place via a disk, so imagine like a thin frisbee, and at the center of that is a black hole. That frisbee is made of gas. That gas gets very hot and it emits all sorts of wavelengths within the electromagnetic spectrum. So actually one of the ways to find these dark objects is to look for a lot of light. And in 1964, we started observing the X-ray universe. And the first missions were rockets. So they went up and they found a really bright object called Cygnus X1. And that's a system where material is being fed from an orbiting star onto a compact object. Now, that compact object could, in principle, be a neutron star or a black hole. So a neutron star is a very, very dense star, but it's not so dense that it's collapsed all the way down to a black hole. And what people did was they looked at how rapidly the X-rays were changing. And that places constraints on the size of the object that's doing all of that swallowing. And it turns out that's orders of magnitude smaller than the size of the sun. Then people found out if you weigh the mass of that star that's feeding material onto this compact object, and you look at the orbital pattern, you can constrain the mass of the compact object. And it turns out that that's too big to be a neutron star. So the only option left is a black hole. So, you know, that was one of the first indirect pieces of evidence that black holes were real.
And how much do we know about how black holes get there in the first place? I mean, are they just these dark, dense pockets of space that have always been there? Or, you know, does something happen for them to suddenly kind of collapse into these, you know, holes that nothing can escape from?
It depends really on what type of black holes we want to talk about. If we're talking about the black holes, like I just mentioned in Cygnus X1, they normally form when you have a massive star that depletes all of its fuel, and eventually that core runs out of fuel and everything collapses down. At the same time as everything's collapsing down, there's a massive supernova explosion, and the thing that's left in the middle is either a neutron star or a black hole, and that depends upon how big that star was. Now, they're what we call stellar mass black holes. Now, there are another couple of varieties of black holes, including supermassive black holes and also micro black holes. So supermassive black holes, we believe, live in the centers of all galaxies, and they're around 1 million to 1 billion times the mass of their sun. They're absolutely enormous. Micro black holes are the other end of the spectrum, and these were these things that people freaked out about the Large Hadron Collider making. And the idea there was that if you have enough energy within a very small pocket of space, that could form this micro black hole, which could then all suddenly start eating and swallow the Earth and stuff, but obviously we're all fine. So those are the ways we normally go about, you know, describing how black holes form.
Okay, so we've got these indirect observations, but until very recently, we haven't had direct observations of black holes. Why is that?
Right. So we have to be very, very clear about what we mean by observe. So LIGO, the gravitational wave interferometer, detected black holes, and we knew there were black holes, but that's not the same as looking at a black hole, right? So they saw the gravitational chirp as two black holes inspiraled and then merged, and the shape of that chirp told us that there were black holes. In terms of actually, here's a picture of a black hole, that couldn't be done until the Event Horizon Telescope came along. And the reason that it's taken so long is that it's actually really bloody hard. So you want to resolve the region that is the event horizon. That's what you want to see. So M87, which has been the target of the Event Horizon Telescope, one of two, the other one being Sagittarius A star, which is the supermassive black hole in our galaxy, sits at a distance of 54 million light years. So it would take light 54 million years to get from M87 to us. Being able to resolve with telescopes is like holding out your hand a foot away and being able to see atoms. Right, so that is incredibly difficult. And to get that sort of, we call it resolving power, you have to put telescopes all over the globe. And the reason for that is that it makes one very, very large telescope with a diameter equal to the longest distance, we call it a baseline, between them. And that diameter is what's crucial for being able to resolve this event horizon in M87 and what made Event Horizon Telescope so successful.
Despite all the many difficulties in directly imaging the shadow of a black hole, scientists have finally done it. After the break, we speak to one of the scientists involved about how they did it and what it means for science.
Knowing with more accuracy the masses of black holes in general gives us a deeper understanding of black holes and perhaps how they form and their evolution over cosmic time.
We'll be back in a minute.
The Voice Lab from The Guardian.
Hey, do you ever want a quick catch-up on the news headlines first thing in the morning while you're making breakfast or getting dressed? Well, if you have a Google Assistant or Google Home, we can help with that. The Guardian Briefing is an experiment from the Voice Lab, which in under 2 minutes brings you up to speed with what you need to know about the day's top stories. We'll make sure you don't miss a thing. To listen at any time, just say, "Hey Google, speak to the Guardian Briefing."
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Hannah Devlin. Before the break, Matt gave us a brief history of black holes, from the theoretical thinking of an 18th century clergyman in Yorkshire, through Einstein's theory of general relativity, up to the more recent indirect evidence. Importantly though, as Matt said, directly observing a black hole has been difficult. That's because, as the name suggests, well, it's black, meaning it permanently swallows anything that dares to cross its threshold, including light. But now, for the first time ever, astronomers have captured the first image of a black hole shadow. One of those scientists is Ziri.
I'm Dr. Ziri Unsi. I'm from the Mullard Space Science Laboratory at University College London.
Ziri joined me in the studio, and I started by asking him how he felt when I showed him the image he helped create.
I'm just dumbfounded for so many reasons. For me, the biggest personal reason actually is that, so I work very much on the theoretical simulations and calculations of what we would expect from Einstein, and I'm just shocked at how similar this image that we've obtained is to our theoretical predictions, and that Einstein seems to be correct once again.
Can you just describe what you're looking at?
So this is basically an image of the shadow of the black hole in M87. So this is like a ring of light, and it's actually matter that's swirling around the black hole at relativistic speeds, and as it's swirling around it gets hotter and hotter and it emits light, and it's that light that we're detecting, and this is the image of that matter that's swirling around.
You mentioned M87, but could you just take me through what, so we're looking at the shadow of a black hole, but what's the black hole called? How big is it? Where is it?
Mm-hmm. So this black hole is called M87 or Messier 87, and this is in the Virgo galaxy cluster, and this is over 55 million light years away. So we're looking back in time over 55 million years, and this black hole is supermassive. In fact, it's one of the biggest black holes we've ever seen, and it's over 6.5 billion times the mass of our sun. So it's really huge, and it's because it's so huge that even though it's far away, we're able to resolve it with this Event Horizon Telescope.
And if you were walking across it from one side to the other, which obviously you would not be able to do, because you wouldn't be able to get out again, how far is it across?
So it's actually larger than our solar system. It's incredibly massive. So that ring that you see in the image, the radius of that ring is larger than the radius of our solar system. So it's enormous, absolutely enormous.
Okay, so just to understand a bit better what we're looking at in this image, obviously, the black hole itself is completely dark. Nothing can escape from it. But we see this kind of halo, slightly lopsided, crescent-like halo of light. What is that light? And you know, why are we able to see that?
There are many aspects to this, but the first thing which we can all agree on is that, as scientists, is that the light is coming from matter that's orbiting the black hole, first of all, and it gets hotter and hotter as it plunges into the event horizon being this region that I think everybody is familiar with by now, where nothing can escape, neither light nor matter. And so we're seeing the light which is coming from that matter moments before it crosses that threshold from within which it will never return. And so this light has a characteristic asymmetry. So it looks brighter in the bottom half of the image than the top. And we believe that that's due to the rotation of the black hole. So the black hole is actually rotating extremely rapidly. And so what's happening is that that matter, which is producing this light that looks brighter in the image, is the matter which is moving towards us.
And okay, so it's being sort of flung towards the Earth, essentially, and that makes it appear brighter.
Absolutely, and this is what we call Doppler boosting, but consequently the upper half of the image, which is the part of the material that's orbiting the black hole, which is moving away from us, is dimmed because it's moving away. And so you get this, what we call an asymmetry in the brightness. So we think this asymmetry is because of the spin of the black hole.
In the first half of this episode, Matt touched on the fact that this image was really hard to obtain. And when he said really hard, he meant it. Remember how he likened it to being able to hold out your hand and see atoms on your finger? That's the level of detail we need. And to obtain it, a network of 8 radio telescopes spanning from Antarctica to Spain and Chile had to work together, essentially forming an Earth-sized telescope. And because they were all working as one, the team also needed good weather at each telescope site at the same time. And Zoe said that came down to a spot of good luck.
Weather, basically. Across all of the sites, for all days, it was beautiful, clear skies, and we were able to observe cleanly all day and night. Now, as a minimum,
the network is known as the Event Horizon Telescope. It involves more than 200 scientists, and in just one night, generated enough data to fill half a ton of hard drives.
Once we have all of this data, and it's a vast amount of data, it's petabytes of data, that's like billions and billions of gigabytes of data. And all of that data is stored at each telescope at that site, because it's such a vast amount of data, we can't transmit it wirelessly, it's impossible. And so they're stored on hard disks. And then once all of the observations are taken, those hard disks are shipped to a central location. And that sounds trivial enough, but actually that in itself is quite an effort, because one of the telescopes in particular is in the South Pole. And there are just, during the winter, you can't fly there. It's a no-fly zone. And so those disks had to wait a few months before we were able to retrieve them.
That must have been a long wait for the people who were working on this project and just desperate to see whether you've got, you know, what you needed.
Absolutely. It was quite frustrating, and also I think tantalizing for everybody who was working on this, because you had a sort of incomplete set of data. So you could kind of start to work with it, but you really needed this additional data from this telescope in order to have a clearer picture of this image.
Without international collaboration among facilities, the contributions of dozens of scientists and engineers, and sustained funding, the Event Horizon project would have been impossible.
So all this work and collaboration has gone into producing this image. How have people reacted once now that you finally unveiled it?
I think most people are shocked that we're even able to take a picture of a black hole because, you know, by definition, it's black. And the first question that most people I meet ask me is, how can you take a picture of something which swallows all of this light and is by definition black and therefore invisible? I think it's just remarkable, incredible, really, that we're able to have an image of what is, in effect, the edge of our universe. I mean, I've said it before, but it really is a one-way ticket. Once you cross that event horizon, you never come back. And we're seeing matter moments before it crosses that horizon. And, you know, I think that it's an important step in our understanding of black holes.
So, Ziri, does this tell us anything about what's inside the event horizon? And in fact, will we ever know what's inside the event horizon?
This is a million-dollar question. right now, unfortunately, it doesn't tell us what's inside the event horizon. We're pushing our observations closer and closer, but unfortunately, nothing will escape this event horizon. So in a sense, communication with the event horizon, beyond the event horizon, is completely impossible. Now, there are many ideas and theories as to what could be happening inside. And I think that in some ways, it's quite useful to go back in time to the very beginning, to, you know, to Reverend John Michel. And he said, well, within Newton's theory of gravity, light behaves like a particle. This is the corpuscular theory of light. And so light would be subject to gravity. And in principle, one could construct a star with a sufficiently large mass concentrated within a sufficiently small volume, so high enough density, that nothing, not even light, could escape its surface. So this star would be perfectly black. And he called them dark stars. And it could be that a black hole is just a dark star. It could be just a star which is so compact, more compact than even a neutron star, that we can't see its surface. Maybe it isn't this crazy wormhole into another dimension or another universe or, you know, this infinite curvature, you know, and crazy stuff that's going on inside. It could just be a more exotic state of matter that we're yet to understand.
But it could be a wormhole.
It could, but I think actually there are observations now that there are people writing papers that are coming out in the press right now ruling out at least this particular black hole in M87 as a wormhole based on the properties of the shadow itself, its apparent size and brightness and the asymmetry. So we think that it's probably not a wormhole. This, at least this black hole isn't a wormhole.
So aside from having produced this amazing image, what can the Event Horizon Telescope tell us about black holes and this crazy environment that surrounds them?
Well, one of the first things we can learn from this image that we've seen, and this will be the first of hopefully many images in the years to come, is the shape of that ring is surprisingly circular. And we actually have a very good understanding of our orientation here on Earth with respect to this black hole. And we know with a very high level of confidence that the size of that shadow depends almost entirely and solely on the mass of the black hole. And therefore, by looking at the size of that shadow, which we have accurately, we have a very good constraint on its mass, the mass of the black hole.
And why does that matter? Why do we want to know the mass of this black hole that's 55 million light years away?
Well, knowing the mass of this black hole accurately, which there are sort of many indirect ways of estimating the mass, but they all, there's some overlap, but there are also discrepancies and disagreements in this. And now we have quite a firm constraint on this. And this is important in order for us to understand the dynamics of the galaxy itself, because the black hole is like the central engine and it powers this. And knowing with more accuracy the masses of black holes in general gives us a deeper understanding of black holes and perhaps how they form and their evolution over cosmic time. And understanding why some of these black holes are so massive, you know, how do they form? Do they form through guzzling gas, or do they form through colliding with other black holes? And once we have a means to estimate these masses more accurately, then we start to develop a clearer picture of what's going on.
Finding out how supermassive black holes got so massive is just one of the many questions that the Event Horizon Telescope team hopes to get closer to answering. But I was left wondering how Albert Einstein might have felt, given that black holes were predicted by his theory of general relativity, especially since he initially believed that they were nothing more than a mathematical oddity. I put this to Matt Middleton.
Wow, it's like the pinnacle of hubris, isn't it? For me to start answering this. I'm doomed if I do this. I think he would have been amazed at what people have done. I think that he would be thrilled that people are chasing down science for science's own merits as well. You know, these are beautiful things that really inspire people and get them thinking about science. And I think he would have been really happy about that. Or he might have been completely chill about it and been like, well, yeah, of course I'm right.
You would have moved on. You'd been doing something that we couldn't
been
even,
on Instagram or
couldn't
something,
even
right?
imagine. Yeah.
I don't know. I'm frightened. I think the ghost of Einstein's going to visit me and plague me from now on.
He might give you some good ideas.
That'd be awesome.
All right. Thanks so much, Matt, for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure.
And also thank you to Zirui for joining us. If you haven't done so already, you can view the black hole picture in all its glory on our website. Just head over to theguardian.com/podcasts and navigate to this week's episode of Science Weekly. The producer was Greya Jackson. I'm Hannah Devlin, and thanks so much for listening. I'll see you next time.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.